Becatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Becatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're really getting into something fundamental. We're looking at Fabio Parascoli's book, Food, Culture, Power, and Global Systems.
Yeah, this is a fascinating one. It basically argues that food isn't just, well, food. It's a lens.
A lens for what, exactly?
For power, for culture, for global economics. If you want to understand inequality, climate change. Look at your plate. That's the core idea.
That's quite a claim, because usually we think about food in terms of taste, maybe health trends, right?
Exactly. And Parascoli says that's part of the problem. He calls it modern food illiteracy.
Food illiteracy. Explain that a bit.
Well, we're drowning in food media. Mm-hmm. You know, the fancy blogs, celebrity chefs, cooking shows.
Oh, yeah, it's everywhere.
But we're completely cut off from where our food actually comes from, the origins, the impact of our choices. We don't see the system.
Okay, so the goal today is to maybe combat some of that illiteracy.
Precisely. We want to use the book to offer a kind of systems thinking approach, helping you connect the dots, you know, between the supermarket shelf and, say, global trade policy.
Sounds important. So who is Fabio Parascoli? Why is he the right guide for this?
Well, he's a big name in food studies, professor at the New School in NYU. But what really makes him unique is how he bridges different fields.
Well, so.
He brings together cultural studies, semiotics, sociology, but he's not just an academic theorist.
Right. The book mentions his background. He grew up in Italy.
Yes, exactly. So he has that deep, sort of visceral understanding of food culture, tradition, terroir, that insider perspective on a place where food is central to identity.
Okay, so the cultural side is covered. What else?
He also worked as a journalist covering foreign policy and economics.
Ah, so he connects the dots.
He really does. He can talk about complex theory and the practical realities of, like, supply chains, market forces, policy decisions. He links the abstract to the everyday meal.
He's the systems thinker you mentioned.
Absolutely. Constantly showing how our personal choices connect to these huge global networks.
And who is he trying to reach with this book? It sounds potentially academic.
Well, yes, it's used in academia, but it's written much more broadly. He's aiming for policymakers, students, sure, but also just curious people.
Anyone who eats, basically.
Anyone who wants to be more than just a passive consumer, who wants to become, as he puts it, an informed food citizen.
I like that term, food citizen. How does the book actually guide us towards that?
It's structured really cleverly. It starts small, with the personal act of eating.
Okay, familiar ground.
And it zooms out systematically. From food as personal identity, what you eat, what your family eats, your national dishes, to these vast, often hidden global systems.
So expanding our perspective step by step.
Exactly. It covers culture and identity, then the political economy, the power structures, the money, then media and tech's role, and finally the big challenges like sustainability and equity.
Does he take a side? Is it all critique or is there appreciation too?
That's the key balance. He definitely celebrates food's joy, its ability to build community. But he's also unflinchingly critical about how these systems create massive inequality and damage the environment. It's both hands.
Okay, that makes sense. It avoids just romanticizing food. Shall we dig into some of those core sections, starting with culture and identity?
Let's do it. This is where he points out how incredibly persistent food habits are. They're often the last thing immigrants give up, for example. Food is just fundamental to who we are.
And he talks about gastronationalism here, right?
Yes. It's this idea that countries actively use food to build and project their national brand.
Like Italy and pasta, or Japan and sushi.
Exactly. It becomes a kind of soft power, even if the history of that dish is, you know, more complex or even contested than the national story admits.
And food also defines who's in and who's out of a group.
Definitely. Think about dietary laws, kosher, halal, or ethical choices like veganism. These aren't just personal preferences. They draw clear lines, reinforcing community boundaries and values.
He has that great line, something like, we're defined not just by what we eat, but by what we refuse to eat.
That's the one, the taboo creates the boundary. Powerful stuff.
And he uses pizza as a case study for this. Seems simple, but
it's a brilliant example. It started as essentially poor people's food in Naples. Really basic.
Hard to imagine now.
Right. And now it's this global phenomenon. Its journey tells a story of migration, cultural exchange, adaptation, industrialization, everything from local necessity to global commodity.
That transition, local necessity to global commodity, feels like the perfect bridge to the next big section, food, power, and globalization. This is where things get less cozy.
Yes. This is where we look at the material forces. Industrial agriculture takes center stage.
Monocultures, chemicals, machines.
All of that. It's built for efficiency, for high yields of a few key crops, and undeniably produces cheap calories. But the environmental cost, soil degradation, water use, biodiversity loss is immense.
But hang on, didn't that efficiency lift millions out of starvation? You can't just dismiss that, surely.
No, absolutely not. He acknowledges that historical context.
Mm-hmm.
But he argues the current system isn't primarily driven by feeding people equitably or sustainably. It's driven by profit and corporate control.
Ah, the corporate control piece.
Yeah, he highlights how a handful of massive multinational corporations, think Cargill, Nestle, companies like that, dominate everything from seeds and chemicals to processing and retail.
So they have huge influence.
Enormous influence. Over markets, prices, and critically, over government policy.
Which brings us to subsidies.
Exactly. Agricultural subsidies, particularly in the U.S. and Europe, heavily favor certain commodity crops, mostly corn and soy.
Why is that a problem globally?
Because it completely distorts the market. These heavily subsidized crops flood the world market at artificially low prices,
making it impossible for farmers in poorer countries to compete with their own local crops.
Precisely. It undermines local agriculture elsewhere and, at the same time, fuels the global spread of cheap, processed foods, often made from that subsidized corn and soy.
Is there an example that really shows these unintended consequences?
Quinoa is the classic tragic example he uses.
The superfood.
Right. Global demand exploded. Prices shot up. Which sounds good for Andean farmers initially.
Wait.
But soon, the price got so high that the local populations in Bolivia and Peru, who had relied on quinoa as a staple for centuries, could no longer afford it.
Wow. So Western health trends created food insecurity in the place quinoa originated.
It starkly illustrates the complex, often damaging ripples of globalized food trends. Your ethical choice here can have negative impacts there.
Okay, moving from the fields and markets.
Mm-hmm.
What about the role of media and technology in all this? You mentioned the food media earlier.
Yeah, Parascoli argues food media doesn't just reflect our tastes, it actively shapes them.
How so?
Think about celebrity chefs, Instagram food porn, those viral recipes. They act as cultural intermediaries. They tell us what's desirable, what's cool, what gives us status.
That perfect avocado toast picture. It's not just about breakfast.
It's about performing a certain lifestyle, acquiring cultural capital.
Absolutely. And what about technology? Things like lab-grown meat or precision farming. Does he see those as solutions?
He urges what he calls critical optimism. He acknowledges the potential benefits, the promises of efficiency and sustainability.
But there's a catch.
There's always a catch. He warns that technology often delivers, and this is a great quote, new forms of inequality disguised as convenience.
Say more about that. What does that mean in practice?
It means we have to ask critical questions. Is this tech truly solving root problems, like fair wages for farm workers or access to nutritious food for everyone? Or is it creating expensive proprietary solutions that benefit investors and wealthy consumers, while maybe even reinforcing the old exploitative structures?
So convenience for some might hide ongoing problems for others.
That's the concern. And looking towards the future, the biggest challenge looming over everything is climate change.
Which the current food system is a huge driver of.
Massive. So for Parascoli, transitioning to genuinely sustainable systems, he mentions things like agroecology, more localized urban agriculture isn't just a nice idea. It's the most urgent task we face.
Wow. Okay, so stepping back from the details, what are the main overarching messages we should really take away from this deep dive, the key themes?
I think the first absolutely crucial one is food is a system, not just a product.
We need that systems thinking you mentioned at the start.
Exactly. You have to train yourself to see the connections. He suggests tracing just one simple thing, like a tomato, backward.
What would that reveal?
Suddenly you're looking at seed patents, migrant labor laws, transportation fuel costs, global commodity markets, supermarket shelf placement strategies, government subsidies. The health of that tomato depends on the health of this incredibly complex interconnected web, most of which is invisible when you just buy it.
That's a powerful exercise. Okay, theme number two.
The interconnectedness of the global and the local. They're not opposites, he says. They're like dance partners.
How does that play out?
Well, think about the rise of local food movements. Farmers markets, slow food.
Right. People wanting to buy local.
Those aren't just happening in a vacuum.
Hmm.
They are a direct response to the pressures of globalization, what some call the McDonaldization of food, where everything starts to taste the same. The local pushes back against the global homogenizing force.
So my choice at the farmer's market, it connects to these bigger global discussions about sustainability and corporate power.
Absolutely. It's a small act within that larger dance. Okay. And the third big theme.
Let me guess. It involves power.
You got it.
Mm-hmm.
Theme three is the politics of food are inescapable.
Meaning?
Meaning every decision about food, what crops get it subsidized, what safety standards are enforced, who owns the land, what's served in school lunches, every single one is a political choice.
With winners and losers.
Always. There's no neutral ground.
Mm-hmm.
Realizing this changes how you see things. It's not just about shopping. It's about policy, advocacy, community engagement.
You can't depoliticize your plate.
You really can't. And Parasekali has such a knack for boiling these big ideas down. Shall we share a few of those key lines?
Yeah, let's do that. They really stick with you. What's the core thesis again?
This one sums it up. Food is never just about food. It is always about power, identity, and relationships. It forces you to look beneath the surface.
And the one about identity.
This is so insightful. We are not only what we eat, but perhaps more importantly, we are defined by what we refuse to eat. It highlights how boundaries are created.
Mm-hmm. And for the consumer, the call to action.
It's direct. Every meal is a political act, whether we are conscious of it or not. Every purchase is a vote, essentially, in the food economy. You're supporting certain practices.
Makes you think twice about impulse buys. And finally, the one on technology.
That warning note. Technology promises to democratize food, but it often delivers new forms of inequality disguised as convenience. A reminder to stay critical, even when something looks like progress.
Okay, these are powerful ideas. How can listeners apply this knowledge? Like, tomorrow, what are the practical takeaways?
Well, application one is pretty straightforward. Become a more mindful consumer.
Beyond just price and calories.
Right. Ask those systemic questions, even about one thing you eat regularly. Who grew the main ingredient? Under what conditions? Where did it travel from? Just doing that research once is eye-opening.
Application two, decode your food environment.
Yeah, look at the supermarket differently. Don't see it as neutral territory. See it as a carefully curated space shaped by corporate power. Who gets the prime shelf space? What's promoted at the end caps? Why?
And apply that critical lens to food media, too.
Definitely. Recognize that Instagram feed or cooking show isn't just entertainment. It's actively shaping your desires, your sense of what's good or prestigious.
Okay, what's application three?
Engage in food citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
Move beyond just being a consumer.
Oh.
It could be supporting policies you believe in, like for sustainable farming or fair wages. It could be getting involved locally, a food bank, a community garden project, advocating for better food education in schools, stepping into the political dimension.
And the last one connects back to culture.
Application four, foster cultural empathy through food. When you try the cuisine of another culture, understand it's more than just tasting something new.
It's an act of learning.
And respect. Food carries stories about migration, history, adaptation, resilience. It's a window into another world that goes much deeper than a history book sometimes.
That's a lovely way to think about trying new foods. So, reflecting on all this, what was most surprising or impactful for you personally?
For me, it was really grasping the intensity of the political fights over seemingly boring things like food safety rules. You assume it's just technical experts, but Parasekali shows it's this constant battleground between corporate interests wanting less regulation and public health folks trying to protect people.
Mm.
It's pure politics.
Yeah, that was eye-opening for me too. And I think the biggest takeaway, the lesson, is really internalizing this idea of food literacy. It's not just about knowing ingredients, it's about understanding the systems.
Right, and the power that comes with that understanding.
Exactly. Recognizing that eating isn't just personal or biological, it's fundamentally social and political. It connects us to everyone else and to the planet. That realization feels, well, empowering. It lets you make choices and maybe even engage in a much more thoughtful way.
Well said. He gives us the tools to see the whole picture.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.